Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. One in every 137 teenagers identifies as transgender, but a wildly disproportionate number of transgender teens in the U.S. suffers from depression and anxiety. Canadian sociologist Ann Travers's forthcoming book covers this issue and more. It is titled The Trans Generation, How Trans Kids and Their Parents Are Creating a Gender Revolution. Ann Travers joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Ann.
A lot of people still grapple with the concept of transgender. Define it for us. Tell us what you mean.
I mean transgender as an umbrella term that encompasses anyone who doesn't feel comfortable or connected to the sex or gender they were assigned at birth.
What do we know about the evidence of the origins of gender identity and how that affects transgenderism?
Well, gender is a social system and a cultural system that people have deep emotional attachment to. Our current gender system is not a neutral one. It emphasizes that there are only two sexes and that, masculinity is linked to male so-called genitalia and vice versa. But it's also linked to a long history of gender inequality, anti-gay attitudes and violence, and anti-girl and woman attitudes.
The society has hidden a lot of what is other than him or her.
Absolutely. And I know that the figure, the most recent figure, is one in 137. Mm-hmm. But one of the things we know about transgender kids is the majority of them are invisible. They never show themselves because they very smartly, very rightly look at their environments, experience their environments, and know that they're very unsafe. So they don't ever announce to anyone. And sometimes they even hide the information deep within themselves.
So is it unclear whether it's a biological construct or a sociological, or that what it is?
I think it is unclear. I mean, there's a long-standing common sense assumption that gender is biologically driven, and that has been disputed by feminist science studies for ages. But it's so taken for granted that people think it's natural. People think that boys are different than girls and girls are different than boys, when in fact, there's an incredible range of, difference, like within people who are assigned the girl identity and within people who are assigned a boy identity.
Do we have any knowledge about whether transgenderism runs in families?
I would say it runs in families if a family has a particular culture and tradition of openness and keeps kids informed that there are a range of sexual and gender options. I think if that is the case, then you're more likely to have a visible transgender person in that family. Whereas in families that are more forbidding, in environments that are harsh and hostile to any kind of gender or sexual diversity, you're not going to see it. But it doesn't mean it isn't there.
We're talking about transgenderism. My guest is Ann Travers, an associate professor of sociology at Simon Fraser University and author of a forthcoming book titled The Trans Generation, How Trans Kids and Their Parents Are Creating a Gender Revolution. The wellness issue here really is mental health. What do we know about why depression and anxiety rates are so disproportionate? It's something like, so we said the working number is one in 137 teens, but 50% of that one in 137 suffer from some form of anxiety, and a larger proportion as well from depression.
Well, it's not really surprising when you consider that these children live in environments that tell them that who they are is not welcome, is wrong, is not normal. The kind of microaggressions they experience around them, especially if they are visible. But when they're not visible, they also experience a lot of harm because they're exposed to negative attitudes and comments about trans people or gender nonconforming people all the time. When one doesn't see oneself reflected back in the environment, that's very harmful. And most of the trans kids that I interviewed had engaged in self-harm and struggled with anxiety. And they described their experiences as being very, very harmful, feeling bullied, feeling unwelcome, feeling like there was something fundamentally wrong with them.
And these are the ones where is there a difference between those who openly identify as transgender of one stripe or another versus those who just keep it hidden their whole lives? Do we have any statistics or any comparables on that score?
Well, we don't have statistics because those who keep it hidden are very hard to measure.
Right.
But it's quite reasonable to assume that many keep it hidden because it's simply not safe to come out. But, I mean, there are some trans kids who never made a decision to come out. They were never in. Mm-hmm. They always were read as gender conforming, and they often experienced a lot of hostility. Even if their family supported them, they have experienced a lot of gender policing from adults and peers. One of the things that we do know about the transgender kids who are out or who are in the open is they are the most they're the most privileged. They tend to have supportive families. They tend to have access to resources. The transgender kids that we can identify are typically doing the best. So if 50% of those who are doing the best are suffering, serious mental health consequences from living in a trans-negative society, think about the kids who don't have the resources and support to be counted.
I mean, partly I think things are, for lack of a better word, are so much better than they used to be. We're even talking about it, on a talk show, on a radio. Even 10 years ago, that would have been, I'm not even sure people would know what we were talking about.
No, I agree with you. This is positive because, people are becoming more aware that transgender people exist. And, there is some positive commentary about trans people. And also because of the internet, trans kids, even if they're keeping it to themselves, may be able to find online communities, examples of themselves where they see themselves reflected back. So that's very positive. But I don't think people are aware that in any group of children, there will be trans kids there. And that's something that we need to think about.
Tell us about the parents' role in all of this. How much does it matter? I would imagine that it's not untypical to have one parent supportive and another parent not. It could be the source of divorces and all kinds of family conflict.
Oh, it is. Absolutely. There are custody battles. Most of the kids that I've interviewed and the parents that I've interviewed are very, very supportive of their kids, and the kids have very supportive parents. But even in supportive families, they'll often talk about a process where one parent got on board really early and had to spend a lot of time educating the other parent to get them to understand that this was okay. But there are numerous cases of custody battles. And 10 years ago, for sure, a parent who was allowing a child to express a trans identity would be very vulnerable to losing custody. Mm. That's starting to change. But certainly I know that in British Columbia, a father went to court to stop his transgender son from receiving puberty suppression therapy. Ultimately, he was unsuccessful, but while the legal case was occurring, the kid, understandably, was completely freaking out.
Some parents allow their trans kids to be their authentic gender at home, but want them to act their assigned gender at school and in public. What's that like? So there is a refuge, there's a place of refuge, but they're asked to play two different roles.
Well, the thing is, it really depends. For some people, keeping their kid just trans at home is a survival matter.
Okay.
The environment that their child would be going into is so dangerous and so forbidding that it's a mutual decision. The child and the parent go, yeah, we cannot do this. This is too dangerous. So it isn't always, the parent imposing limits on the kid because of their own insecurity, but rather it's a safety issue. And kids describe this as torture. being one thing at home and one thing at school, they find it incredibly stressful. But some kids choose this option themselves because they deeply fear the consequence of coming out. They fear that they will have no friends, that they'll be alone, that their lives will be awful. And, you know, some kids have talked about their experience of, you know, going through a transitional phase where they were their authentic gender at home and they were their assigned gender at school, you know, just because the family wasn't ready to adjust. And they talk about this as absolute torture, you know, feeling that the world is a huge weight on them, mm-hmm. that who they are isn't allowed. They hate the sound of their assigned name. They hate being told to go and stand with the boys. They find it incredibly traumatic.
What are the medical issues most often associated with people who are trans? Are there any typical medical problems?
No, there aren't typical medical problems. And a lot of people assume that transgender is necessarily a medicalized identity.
Mm-hmm.
One student told me that when her parents told the principal, like when she was about 9, that she was trans, the first thing the principal said is, "Has she had the surgery?" And you think, "Oh my God, like her surgery is not performed on 9-year-olds." Mm-hmm. And many trans people never take hormone therapy or undergo surgery, but some do. And for children, the most common medical treatment is that of puberty suppression therapy. Say a child is 10 or 11, right before puberty, they feel very, very clear that they are not the assigned sex, that, you know, the sex assigned to them. And if they're able to access medical care, they can receive hormone blockers, which is a therapy that was designed in Holland. It's called the Dutch Protocol. And hormone blockers are entirely reversible. And what they do is they give the kid a couple of years to figure out what they really want to do. To just give them a couple of years to be sure that a trans identity, you know, fits best for them.
Are there people who want to be both?
Yes, or neither.
Yeah,
one of
right.
the really exciting things about my research, interviewing trans kids and young people, has been the new language that they've taught me.
Mm-hmm.
There's a category called agender, and that is someone who doesn't identify as a gender at all. Gender systems just don't work for them, and they prefer not to be associated with any particular gender. There are people who affirm non-binary identities, meaning being a boy or a girl, neither is a solution for them. So they, you know, they identify somewhere in the middle, and we're seeing the increasing popularity of pronouns like they, them, theirs to describe people for whom he or she just simply don't resonate.
You know, you and I talked before we came on the air because, you know, you identify as transgender, you're transgender. And I said, well, you know, forgive me in advance if I flub up my pronouns, and talk a little bit about the etiquette of the pronouns, what it means to you individually, you know, to you personally, and what you learned from your subjects for the book.
Well, I learned that for many of my subjects, pronouns are incredibly important. Mm-hmm. If you use the wrong pronoun, then they don't feel seen or understood. Mind you, most of the kids I talk to are very forgiving of genuine mistakes, of people who are forgetting or remembering. And, I mean, sometimes I forget somebody's new pronoun, and the appropriate thing to do is to immediately apologize, mm-hmm. don't make it a big deal, and try really hard to get it right the next time. Some people aren't, like, pronouns aren't that important. Like, for me, I mean, I've been using she for 55, 56 years. So, mm-hmm. you know, I've kind of made my peace with it. But in general, I prefer they, them, theirs, but it's not a big deal, like, for me. But for many people, it's incredibly important. And, you know, I work really hard to get somebody's pronouns right, because I know that to build trust and good relationships with people, you need to recognize them and use the pronoun that, you know, they really feel is right for them. But people are going to make mistakes, and adjusting to new pronouns is a process. So I just want to emphasize that most trans people that I know are very understanding when people are making a genuine, committed effort.
Ann Travers, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Ann Travers is an associate professor of sociology at Simon Fraser University and the author of a forthcoming book, it coming out June 5th, The Trans Generation, How Trans Kids and Their Parents Are Creating a Gender Revolution. More Wellness Wednesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Marriage rates are declining in the U.S., and that is important because in 2 years, the millennial demographic will include more members of a typical marrying age than any previous generation. That's a new report from eHarmony. Ronnie Rabin recently wrote about the report and its findings for the New York Times wellness blog. She joins us now by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So millennials like the idea of marriage, but they're putting it off. It doesn't sound that different than, you know, incrementally than the generations that went before them.
Well, I don't know. When you talk to people, it does sound different. And since I did this article, I've actually met with some parents of adult children who are, you know, a little bit older, and they'll say things like, just out of the blue, I don't know what's going on. My son and his girlfriend have been living together for 7-8 years. They're really happy together. They seem to be doing fine. They're just not interested in getting married. I mean, it has changed from being a goal that you set yourself. You know, I want to go to college. I want to get married. I want to have children. I want to take trips around the world, mm-hmm. to something that really is an end game. It's almost like they feel like the marriage will end, is the end of everything, as opposed to the beginning of adult life. And partly it's just because they can live together without mm-hmm. much social opprobrium. They can do a lot of things. They can advance their careers. There's very little social sanction to it.
They are, some people, they're doing it for practical reasons.
I think finances are a big part of this. This is a generation that, especially if they're educated, and this probably is a trend that's even more extreme among educated young adults, they have student debt. The cost of housing is high. And even the cost of a wedding is high. One couple said to me, one lovely couple didn't make it into the story, said, we're engaged, but we don't even have rings. Rings are so expensive. Mm-hmm. So finances are definitely playing a role. And I think that women, I mean, at the risk of sounding sexist, I do think that women in earlier generations were the ones perhaps more pushing for, you know, are we getting married or mm-hmm. should I move on kind of thing. And I think that now women are pursuing their careers and they know that marriage may hamper them in some ways. And they're very happy to live their lives, especially if they're living with a partner.
You know, I was thinking go ahead.
What's interesting is that a lot of these people are in very committed couple relationships.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking about that dichotomy of, you know, they're in these committed relationships. They're, you know, they're not necessarily against marriage, but they can't afford the wedding. And it makes me wonder if the wedding industry hasn't done itself more harm than good by creating these lavish scenarios that everyone needs to. I mean, just some people who get engaged, it's lavish, just the engagement part of it. It kind of made me wonder if they're just have created this impossible goal.
I also thought about that, and I didn't do any research on it, but I wonder what's happening with weddings as well. I think there's another element too here, which mm-hmm. is the one time they do say they will get married, they want to be married if they have children. Most mm-hmm. of them say that, but there's ambivalence about children, as you know, it's probably normal. But there's also an idea that fertility can be extended, that there isn't for women. not just for men, and that you can, so that, that not only you can have children whenever, but that having children is an option. That's something that people talk about more. It's not a have to do, a must do.
Mm-hmm.
But we've got egg freezing, and, you know, there's
That's
no
right.
rush.
Right.
Which may or may not be true, and it's very expensive, and it's a grueling process, but I think there isn't that sense of a looming deadline of the biological clock for women.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with Rani Rabin. She is a writer for the New York Times Wellness blog. She wrote recently about a survey done by eHarmony of millennials. So it's going to be the biggest generation ever. And they're hitting that marriageable age, the one we think of typically. What would that be, Rani, like 22 to 32 or something?
I think the median age now is 29, which means for men and 27 for women, I think. And that means half are married by that age and half are married after that age. So we're talking about, you know, probably into the 30s. And you know, a lot of this is also professional couples. The one couple I interviewed met in architecture school. That's a tough 5-year-long program. When they get, they dated for most of that time. They were friends first, then they dated. Were quite serious, but their jobs took them to different cities. They stayed in touch, saw each other a lot. After 2 years, were able to relocate to the same city. 2 years later, got engaged on their 7th anniversary of dating. They met in 2009 when they started architecture school. And from my talk with Harsha Royuro and Alan Kawahara, it could easily be 2019, 10 years from when they met, when they actually get married.
And they're perfectly fine. They don't feel like, wow, what a hassle it's been and what a, you know, slog.
I think it was a hassle when they were living apart, but
yeah.
I think they both feel they got so much out of it. That's the other thing you hear from these young people. They feel so independent. They feel like they're very self-sufficient. They feel like they grow very much through the experience of living together or even living apart and not being married.
Yeah.
They often have do a lot of things together, but have separate interests that they pursue separately, or they have separate groups of friends, sometimes come together or not. There's not a sense of we have to do everything together because we're a couple. And you hear that a lot, and they find it very invigorating. And very healthy.
I wonder if it's too early to tell if this is going to have a positive effect on those who eventually do marry, if they get to know each other better and if they live together longer and that kind of a thing.
Well, that's what the experts say. They say people who marry later in general are known to have those marriages stick for longer, have longer marriages. And they're less likely to divorce. I don't know if there's any data on how long dating beforehand, but definitely people who marry older tend to have more successful marriages. So, yeah, they have a long time to test drive it.
This is eHarmony conducted this survey. What is eHarmony getting out of it? How does it change, you know, that kind of that scenario of online dating and so forth?
Well, you know, eHarmony, it's study was focused on happy relationships, what makes relationships happy. And, of course, they try to make successful matches. So they're trying to find out what the ingredients are of a healthy relationship. And, you know, there's some things that they found that are, we know, you know, people who have a little more money tend to have less stress and have more successful relationships. People who live in cities, I think, had more successful relationships for some reason. 25 to 34-year-olds report having the happiest relationships compared to other age groups. You know, so they're trying to pick up on what makes people happy so that they can help match people up better.
We have an email from Sarah in Columbus. She writes, I've been engaged for 3 years. I'm 30 years old and haven't once talked with my fiance about getting married. I think marriage comes with a lot of pressure and baggage, and young couples just don't want to deal with it. Does that sound familiar?
Yeah, I mean, I think the whole stress, you mentioned the wedding industry the stress around organizing a wedding, orchestrating a wedding really is huge. And the expense and the negotiation between families and the getting bogged down in these details can be very, very stressful. And apparently in parts of Europe, I think in Germany, people will get married 10 years after they have a child together.
Yeah, that's a thing.
Yeah, so I don't know how much that's happening here. The idea of having children seems to be the one thing that forces people to want to get married.
Did they say why?
I think they know there's certain benefits that marriage has. They refer to tax benefits in our tax structure. So I think probably to appease the families as well.
How has the media and how it portrays marriage, and I guess I'm talking about cultural media, entertainment media, how it portrays marriage and relationships, how has that played a role in the circumstances of millennials and marriage?
I don't really know. I mean, I did ask several of them if their own parents' relationships and or divorces had affected them. And I think that's definitely out there. I mean, we know that divorce rate is very high. But some of these couples had parents who were divorced, some didn't. And they didn't seem to say it affected them directly or their decision. I think they are enjoying their adult lives, and they don't see any reason to make a change.
You know, Sarah, the person who emailed, she says they've been engaged for 3 years and they've never talked about the wedding or about getting married. I'm wondering why they got engaged in the first place. Any sense about that?
I think it's a commitment to each other that they're making.
Okay.
And I have to say, this other couple, Shanika and John, who I didn't quote in the story, but they said, we've made commitments to each other. We have no doubt we're going to spend our lives together. We have made commitments in several different ways to each other, and to take that commitment and make it in front of family and friends would be nice, and we'd like to do that, but it's sort of besides the point in some ways. They didn't use that word, but they feel like the private, intimate commitment they make to each other is more important than a commitment in a church or in a synagogue or in a community hall in front of other people.
What about legal issues? You know, say somebody gets sick or somebody, you know, has kind of legal issues. What kind of rights? Are they concerned about legal rights and that sort of thing?
That's a very good question. I think they're young enough that they don't really think about those things happening.
Mm-hmm.
And aren't thinking about wills or estates or anything. And some of them do buy property together, and then they both have their names on the lease. And it's jointly shared, jointly owned. In some places, you can, if you need health, I'm thinking health benefits, health insurance.
Yeah.
That may prod people into a marriage at some point. Some places have domestic partnerships, so they don't have to do that. But these people are young, and they're generally not thinking about worst case scenarios.
Well, I guess I've just dated myself. What?
what's? No, I mean, it's a good point. It's a really good point.
I mean, if they get sick and they're in the hospital, what kind of rights do they have to decide? You know what to do? Do they? I suppose. I mean, you know, I'm thinking. You know, a health care power of attorney, that kind of a thing is an option. But what surprised you, Ronnie, about all of this? What did you see in it that caught your eye that surprised you?
It just surprised me because it seemed different from, and now I'll date myself. I have a daughter who's a millennial. I have a bunch of daughters who are millennials. And I have just gotten the instinctive feeling that mentioning the M word to my one daughter who has a boyfriend is just taboo. And I didn't really understand why. And I think it's just not on their radar screen yet. It's really not. And I think it was more of a life goal or an accomplishment to get married. Getting married was a sign of, I don't know, prestige or status. It was a certain achievement. It was a certain step in adulthood, a stage in adulthood. And that's really not the case anymore. One sociologist called these capstone marriages. He said the capstone's the last stone you put in that archway. And that's how these younger people are thinking about it. They're thinking, well, once we have everything set up, maybe we've even bought a house together. You know, we're living together. We've established a friend circle. We are professionally established. Then we'll get married. Then we'll have the party to celebrate all the achievements. So it's a different attitude.
I have an email from Spencer in Dublin. He says, I feel like our parents' generation ruined marriages for us with so many divorces. At least for me, that turned me off to the whole marriage idea. Thanks.
I have to say, several people did say completely spontaneously in these interviews, I like the fact that I get up every day and make a decision to be with my partner. I'm not here because I have to be here. We're here every day. We spend time together because we want to, because we get along and we want to. So I think that does get at that fear of divorce and concern that marriage will kind of change things. In a way that they can't even imagine or envision, because they do. They really talk about marriage as like the end of everything. settling down. Like that's the end. That's the end. And you stop traveling. You stop having adventures. You stop going out.
Sad.
You settle down. You have kids, and you hunker down. They kind of talk of it as as like the end.
Let's hear from Brendan in Columbus. Brendan, you're on the air. Hi, Brendan.
Hi. I was calling in regards to say that I have two friends who, just on a whim, they've been engaged or have been a couple for a long time, and they just went to the courthouse just to do it, just to say, okay, we're married now, we're done, we'll have the ceremony later. So I agree with what they're saying about how a marriage, the ordeal, can be a big deal. So that was my comment.
Well, are you a millennial?
Yes.
Well, what do you think about all this?
It's a complicated question. I like the idea that I'm married, but at the same time, planning that wedding was a major pain in the butt, and it was really expensive. I mean, it was stressful.
Yeah.
There's a lot of things to do.
Yeah.
So I can see why people are just, going to the courthouse. Like I said, I had two friends who did it,
mm-hmm.
and I can see why people don't want to, are afraid of that, planning that big party and all that money and all that stuff.
Yeah. Thanks, Brendan. Thanks for listening.
Yeah, no problem.
Email from Kim in Upper Arlington writes, the idea that millennial women invented the concept of furthering their careers before marrying is silly. Educated boomer women and generations X and Y all did the same thing. That's why fertility treatments are so prevalent. And I'll just speak for myself, Ronnie. I certainly did. I put off marriage. I just knew that. And I'm old now.
All relative.
Yeah, it is all relative. I don't feel old. I feel, you know, but you know, I have to agree with Kim in Upper Arlington. Is it just becoming more prevalent now?
It seems to be becoming more prevalent, and the age of marriage seems to be, has been rising. It has been rising continuously since 1960 or 19.
Yeah.
It has been continuing to rise. Yeah. You're right. I mean, they didn't invent it.
Right.
Millennials didn't invent it.
Just a lot more of them are doing it.
I think probably the numbers are bigger.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, look, we're seeing 50% women in medical schools and in law schools. And,
right.
You know, we're seeing in some very serious professional, very serious professional aspirations. And I think that the other thing that has changed is student debt.
Yeah. Yeah.
Even though two can live cheaper than one and all that, there's this idea that we need to get rid of some of this, you know, cut down this student debt before we can make a big decision.
Yeah.
And that probably plays into the whole of very expensive weddings.
I
completely understand the temptation of running to City Hall,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, being on a trip somewhere and going to City Hall and avoiding conflict with families. It's not just expense. It's the stress.
That's a lot of stuff.
Your bite, how big do you make it? Yeah, right. Kind of intimidating.
Well, Ronnie Rabin, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Ronnie Rabin is a writer for the New York Times wellness blog. She wrote about a recent study by eHarmony on the prevalence of waiting for marriage among millennials. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. More Wellness Wednesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. More than 6 in 10 Americans favor ending the prohibition on marijuana. That's according to a recent Quinnipiac poll, which also found that lawmakers on both sides of the aisle are more likely these days to vote for legalization than condemn it. But in a rush to legalize, don't overlook the science of the dangers of marijuana use, says Bucknell University neuroscience and psychology professor Judith Grizel. Professor Grizel recently wrote about the issue for The Washington Post. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. She joins us by now. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Ann. Thanks.
What do we know about how marijuana use affects our brains?
Well, it's a complicated drug in a way because it acts all over the brain. So drugs like cocaine, for instance, and even opiates have more precise places of action, but marijuana, especially THC, which is the active component, the reason that people like it recreationally anyway, interacts with proteins that are really throughout the brain. So it's been a bit of a surprise to learn about probably in the last 20 or 25 years. We've begun to understand quite a lot, and that is that marijuana will influence all kinds of neural processes, including those associated with our thoughts and our feelings and our behavior.
I guess the question is, how much do we know about what kind of permanent impact or effect marijuana
right.
can have, right?
Yeah. That's a tough one because the studies, the controlled studies haven't really, just getting going.
Mm-hmm.
We do have good animal model studies that are showing that the effects very much depend on the dosing and in particular the developmental age. So for young people, the effects seem to be more robust and longer lasting. And for those people who are kind of out of development in humans, that would be maybe after age 25 or so, mm-hmm. the effects tend to be less permanent.
And, you know, one of the things we hear about, not in Ohio yet, but in states where they've legalized it, particularly medicinal marijuana, is there's lots of different kinds of marijuana or brand, or I don't know how you say,
mm-hmm.
Strengths, different kind of pot creates different kinds of sensations. Does that come into play at all in what you've looked at?
Well, the research is kind of just beginning. And initially, we looked at marijuana as, you know, the plant and did it have benefits? Did it have harms? But we realized that, like tobacco, for instance, there are many different compounds. The two that are of most interest are the THC and the cannabidiol. Now, an interesting thing about that is that cannabidiol has no psychoactive properties. In other words, it doesn't change the way you feel or think at all. And in fact, it's an antagonist for THC. So the more cannabidiol you have, the less THC will produce its effects. Of course, the breeders have figured this out, and you can breed for high THC effects, which means low cannabidiol concentrations, or you could do the opposite. There's no risk that we know of for cannabidiol, so we can synthesize it in the lab, and it produces definite effects
benefiting a certain type of childhood epilepsy that is has been intractable or untreatable by traditional medicines. And so this is a safe drug, as far as we know, has no mind-altering properties, and is definitely showing some benefit in the clinic. THC, on the other hand, has mixed results in the clinical studies, and they're just getting going. But I think one of the things that you're alluding to is that these are often conflated. So what people are generally talking about is the proportion of cannabidiol to THC.
Okay. You looked at the effects marijuana can have when it comes to teens who are 7 times more likely to attempt suicide if they're heavy marijuana users. Is that a correlation at this point or a causation? In other words, are suicide prevalence of suicide, couldn't that be just another manifestation of an already suicidal or child?
It sure could be. These studies haven't been done, and it would be, first of all, this is not my study. I was referring to one that was conducted recently somewhere else. But this is always a difficult question, and it was for a long time, conflating, for instance, the relationship between cancer and tobacco smoking. So for the longest time, the cigarette companies argued that people who were just happened to be prone to cancer also liked to smoke cigarettes. It was a coincidence. And it's difficult to prove, because you'd really have to take two groups of people and assign one to heavy smoking and one to no smoking, and then see if there's more suicides. Of course, that would be unethical. So there's right now a link, and there's a good reason to suspect that the link is causal from the animal model studies. So there we can see that animals exposed during development tend to have more anxious behavior and more depression-like behavior later on. We also see changes as a result of the amount of smoking that a human participates in. That there's more... there's sort of a dose-dependent effect on the brain. So it doesn't look... It seems more likely that it's causal, but it has not been proven.
I mean, all things being equal, the problem is, across the board, is that there just haven't been a lot of studies on marijuana, because it was ranked as a Schedule I drug, and studies were forbidden.
I think this is often a problem, and really there are so many things to study. So there's been a lot on alcohol, a lot on nicotine, a lot on cocaine. We've seen those problems in the clinic, and it's, you know, there are thousands of researchers around the world trying to study these drugs, and many are trying to study marijuana. It's just, as you say, kind of getting off the ground, I'd say.
You are interested in the issue of addiction. There's been debates about whether marijuana is addictive. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, I think that any drug that we take regularly that changes the way our brain works, the brain will adapt to. And that adaptation makes you kind of tolerant and dependent and often craving. So, for instance, I am a caffeine fiend these days, and I drink coffee first thing in the morning every morning. And so my brain is kind of prepared for that by the fact that when I wake up, I'm not awake as my child is. I'm awake in a kind of a lethargic near a comatose state until I get coffee, and then I feel normal. So that's just a function. The brain is so good at adapting that it kind of counteracts any regular exposure. If you drink alcohol to relax, it makes you more anxious. If you drink something to alleviate, I mean, if you take something to alleviate pain, it makes you feel more pain. If you take something to stimulate your imagination and make the world more interesting, my argument is, and others, I think, that the world would become more dull without it.
We've talked about the neurological issues, and I know that's your wheelhouse, but what about marijuana if it's smoked? What are the problems with lung issues?
Mm-hmm. Well, we think it's much better than cigarettes.
Okay.
But, of course, now we have e-cigarettes and Juuls, and those were people are hoping are better than cigarettes, and it looks like they're going to be, although they're not by any means innocuous.
Mm-hmm.
And marijuana probably isn't either. Also, I heard from somebody that the pesticide, as the cultivation is getting more out in the open,
mm-hmm.
there's more pesticide use. So we may end up with some of the same problems we had with nicotine. I suppose it depends where it comes from, what it's been sprayed with. But in general, taking particulates into your lungs is not a great idea. It's not good for pollution. It's not good for smoke of any kind. So it's probably not ideal.
You're cautionary about proceeding with medical marijuana laws, or is it just legalization of recreational marijuana that has you worried?
Yeah, I think I'm sort of actually agnostic on this. So I mm-hmm. think that I want to make it. I think it should be clear to everybody that just because something is legal, it doesn't mean it's safe. That's not the case with alcohol. It's not the case with nicotine, and it wouldn't be the case with marijuana either. So the laws often don't reflect the medical and scientific knowledge. Therefore, I think people should avail themselves of as much of that knowledge as they can and make informed decisions. So I'm really more for education than for legislation. Either way, I think people should have their eyes open as much as they can.
You mentioned in the article that you used to smoke marijuana. How does that play into when you look at the kind of questions you ask as you study this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I sure did. I loved the drug. I really, it was the highlight of my, a decade or so of my life. And it was tough to give up, but if somebody can use it in moderation, I think moderation is one way to sort of obviate the problem with the brain adapting. So the brain adapts to chronic regular exposure to anything much better than it would, for instance, to intermittent exposure. So for me, I went the chronic route, and I smoked as much as I could. It was a different time. The drugs weren't quite as potent.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly it does inform things for me, because I think that some of the changes I experienced, this is all anecdotal, so this is not an experiment for sure,
mm-hmm.
but some of the changes I experienced in my relationships, in my motivations, in my behaviors, I think I could attribute in part to the fact that I was stoned often. And and even though I loved it in the beginning, it kind of eventually morphed into a habit that was a consolation from being sober, but really didn't give me the benefits that I had experienced initially.
Did you have? Did you struggle to give it up?
I did. I did it. I gave up several drugs at the same time, and I would say I could talk about any of them. But marijuana was, I guess they would call it your drug of choice. So if I had to be on a desert island and I could only have brought one, it would have been marijuana,
mm-hmm.
and seeds, so I could grow some more probably.
And matches. Yeah.
Yeah. And matches, right? Oh, good one. So it took me a while to stop really missing it. I did get over it eventually. And I occasionally think about it. I really did enjoy it. And mm-hmm. I think it's a wonderful treat if you can use it, moderately.
We only have about a minute left, and I was wondering, what kind of studies would you like to see? Just all of the above that you've already mentioned, but more extensive and longitudinal?
Yeah, I guess I should follow up on that, if you can afford it, the intermittent use. I think we really need to be careful about the adolescent use. And I think if something is really prevalent and if it's advertised all the time, we're giving a mixed message to children. So I think there definitely needs to be more dissociating the effects in adults versus in developing brains and even in prenatal brains. So that's a lot of research.
Judith Grizzell, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Anne. Have a good day.
You too. Judith Grizel, psychology professor and behavioral neuroscientist with an interest in addiction at Bucknell University. That's it for Wellness Wednesday today. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.